done it. That's the value that we have. There's no power on earth greater than the power of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, saying those two precious words, "I understand. I understand. Tell me about it. And I'll tell you, I'll share my experience with you." And it's lifted a load off of many a gal that was really angry about the fact that their husband would still drink at business dinners, whether he drank all the time or not. But he would still come in from a business dinner and, you know, she could smell the wine or smell whatever. And it was ruining an otherwise good marriage. I'm not talking about a marriage with other problems. That's not what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what step three is talking about. And our little serenity prayer is so beautiful, and I always like the fact that he chose to end up step three. Step four. The principle that we put in here is action. Let's get busy. Right up here. Let's put it into action. Action and courage, because any action takes courage. Anything we do takes that courage, that I think I can. I want to give it a try. And along with courage, we always know that I might not be able to do it. But I'm going to give it everything I've got. And that's where we bring the honesty, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Our big book does a beautiful job of telling us how to do our fourth step. All our little 12 and 12 does, and a lot of people, like I say, they throw up a block about the 12 and 12, not realizing that it's a complementary thing. That it goes on and expands on the big book. He gave us the most beautiful paragraph here that I've ever seen that tells us how to start on step four with what attitude I'm to begin step four with. And he said, creation gave us instincts for a purpose. Without them, we wouldn't be complete human beings. If men and women didn't exert themselves to be secure in their persons, made no effort to harvest food or construct shelter, there would be no survival. If they didn't reproduce, the earth wouldn't be populated. If there were no social instincts, if man cared nothing about the society of one another, there could be no society. So these desires for the sex relation, for the material and emotional security, and for companionships are perfectly necessary and right and surely God-given. These are basic instincts that all men are created with. We all want to be secure in our persons. We all want to have the things in our lives that make us feel secure and protected. That's a God-given instinct. They want us to feel well towards our fellow man and to feel a sense of belonging. We want to reproduce the earth. All of these are God-given instincts. And he reminds us that every one of us possess these. But when you take an instinct and get it out of kilter, this is when it's going to hurt you or the regular Joe walking down the street out there. He puts it so well when he says, yet these instincts, so necessary for our existence, we can't really exist without these instincts, often far exceed their proper function. Powerfully and blindly and many times subtly, here's the word, they drive us, they dominate us, and insist upon ruling our lives. Our desires for sex, for the material and emotional security, and for an important place in society often tyrannize us. When thus out of joint, man's natural desires cause him great trouble, practically all the trouble there is. Now, did they tell us that when out of joint, the alcoholic's natural desires cause him great trouble? That's not what it says here in my book. It says man's natural desires. So they're telling us once again, you're a human being, Willie. And I don't care how far you are away from a drink. these natural God-given instincts are here today as they were back then. And those are the ones that I've got to keep on as even a keel as I possibly can. Balance, balance, balance. If I get them too far this way, if I get them too far this way, I'm going to be out of kilter. Man's troubles, and he says that practically all the trouble there is, and he says no human being, not alcoholic, no human being, however good, is exempt from these troubles. Nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. When that happens, our great natural asset, the instincts, have turned into physical and mental liabilities. When we try to not just be, you know, around here, balance. When I go to my job and try to, you know, make everybody else well aware that I am the best teacher in that building. That you girls just out of college, you don't know from nothing. And these kids are going to take you and turn you every way but loose. Now those thoughts might go through my mind once in a while. And I sort of feel sorry for the young ones coming in there. But the thing of it is, that social instinct, if I'm going to do any guidance, I have to do it gently. I have to keep the instinct, the social instinct, in my mind. That yes, I can really get these young teachers told, you're not doing it right. And what am I going to do with a natural, God-given desire of a social instinct to be well-liked and to be well-thought of? As well thought of as I behave in my actions that are brought on by my thoughts. It says step four is our vigorous and painstaking effort to discover what these liabilities in each of us, and look, it says have been, that means all the way back there, and are. I like the way he puts that, because not only did I have to look back and see, well, it was, you know, was lying, has it always been a part of your nature? Have you always, and many people, have had that big old empty hole from the very beginning that they can remember. And that alcohol filled up that hole and gave them confidence that they'd never had and gave them a feeling of well-being that they'd never had. But any time we put that word all to describe all of us, we're not helping ourselves and we're not helping the people that we're trying to help. Because I had never had that feeling of not belonging, of not being accepted. I had always been outgoing. I'd always liked people. Hell, there wasn't enough people in Spring, Texas to dislike. You know, there just wasn't that much choice. We were all kissing kin. I grew up feeling good about Willie. I went off to college. Felt good about Willie. I had a ball in college. I'd gone on to Houston, started teaching school, and I was having, from the first 6 weeks of teaching school, I knew that was the only thing I ever wanted to do to make a living. I married a man that I wanted real bad, and I was real satisfied with my choice. I made a good choice. But see, I had to find out, hey, Willie, that have been back there doesn't mean anything. Sure, you've always been outgoing with people. I've never been the shy, retiring, violent type. I always was one that, you know, wanted to put on the war paint and go raid the village. I was ready to go. Anytime anybody said go, let's you know, go to the dance, let's go here, let's go there, I was ready. And I always felt good. Nothing in my childhood had made me feel any different. And it is different with people that have always had this feeling of not belonging. Their circumstances were different. But I must not, when I'm dealing with my new gals, I must not put them in, like so many people that are studying us, put them in these little holes in an egg carton and expect them to fit. We're all, from Bill says, we're like those passengers on that ship. So it's In step four, that's what I'm after. Our big book tells us how to get it, to put those, put these things down in their columns. Put those resentments down. Write down all the people that we resent. They give us good directions. And in this 12 and 12 are so many added suggestions that Bill had come up with in that 12 and 13 year interval. He had come up with a lot of them. And I hope that and I know many of you are as familiar with this book as I am, but those of you who are not, take note of some of the things that he says in step four. On page 48, he talks about falling into confusion about what all of these things are called. He said to avoid falling into confusion over the names these defects should be called, let's take a universally recognized list of major human failings. The seven deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. Fancy word for lazy. Let's look at those. If you don't know where to begin, if you don't know how to really get a gal going that's still sort of vague up here, you can take those and start, because they give her an idea of some of the things in her that are out of balance, way out of balance. For pride leading to self-justification, and that's where pride will lead you, and always spurred by conscious or unconscious fear, is the basic breeder of most human difficulties. Fear. Ring around. Fear. The chief block to the progress. True progress. Pride lures us into making demands upon ourselves and upon others which cannot be met without perverting or misusing our God-given instinct. If I would have continued to try to make that man bend to my will, you know where the marriage would have been, down the tube. When the satisfaction of our instinct for sex, security, and society becomes the sole object of our lives, then pride steps in to justify our excesses. And look at this next. All of these failings generate fear. And look how it describes fear, and see if you don't agree with it. A soul sickness in its own right. When we become afraid about the future and what's going to happen to our jobs and what's going to happen to this and what's going to happen to the whole world seems to be going crazy. And this fear, and we have to watch it now more than we've ever had to watch it, because the world is going a little bit wacko. Man's inhumanity to man nowadays just absolutely... it can cause us to fall into this fear. The fear of, you know, doing things that I used to do without even thinking about it. Getting in my car at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night and scooting someplace. I don't do that anymore. But see, there's healthy fear too. And it need not be fear. I can turn it into caution. And I can't jump in that car and go across the city of Houston anymore like I did when I was growing up there. But I can turn that into caution and not fear of what's becoming of the world. Where is it all going to end? I don't have to make a big drama out of it. I can look at the fact that it's no longer real smart for a woman to get in the car and run around at night by herself in a big city. It's just not the smart thing to do. I heard that. I do not ride my motorcycle at night by myself anymore either. Because fear, as he describes it here, that soul sickness. Because fear can make you sick all over. It can make you physically sick. That unnamed fear out there of the unknown. It can make us mentally sick, and dear God, it can make us emotionally sick. Then fear, in turn, generates more character defects. Unreasonable fear that our instincts will not be satisfied drives us to covet the possession of others, to lust for sex and power, to become angry when our instinctive demands are threatened, to be envious when the ambitions of others seem to be realized while ours are not. We eat and we drink and we grab for more of everything than we need, fearing we shall never have enough. And with genuine alarm at the prospect of work, we stay lazy. We loaf and procrastinate. Now, we can rationalize that procrastination is not a form of laziness, but 'tain't true. If I got a closet in my house that needs cleaning real bad, it's gotten to the point where I don't even want to open the door. So I just keep passing by it. And I said, well, now, I'm gonna do that next week. I'm going to go put that on my list right now. I'm going to do that next week. And I keep on putting it off. And I keep on putting it off. A year later, that closet is still in a terrible shape. And that's not because I haven't had time to jump in there and clean that closet out. That's pure laziness. That putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, that's where the seven deadly sin of just plain old laziness comes in. And all the time, every time, and you housewives know this, you gals that keep house, every time you pass by that closet, there's this little pang that hits you. And we bury it, and we walk by in the pang, and we bury it. And God, aren't we happy when we get in there one day full of, you know, what and vinegar, and we get in there and we throw everything out of that closet, put back just the things that belong there. Man, when we close that door, don't we feel good? You men feel that same way when you fix your car, when it's been a banging and a clanging and making strange noises, and you just haven't had the time to get up under the hood and see if is there something flapping or loose or gone or what. You feel good when you get it fixed. You feel a little bit more secure when you get in the morning and start to work. That laziness can really get us done. Said, we loaf and procrastinate, or at least work grudgingly and under half steam. These fears, I love this sentence, I love them. These fears are the termites that ceaselessly devour the foundation of whatever sort of life we try to build. And see, this is what our defects will do to us. If we don't look at what they are, pinpoint them, as our directions in both books give us a way to do that. I hear people say, I just don't know how to take step four. There's directions in the big book, beautiful directions. There's some further directions and helpful hints here. It tells us how. And unless we don't have the ability to read, and even then we can't get by because we can find somebody to read it to us. All these books are in Braille. There's no escape once we really want to get serious with this thing. We can do. All right, now what do we do? And oh man, it hurts me. Step five, quickly. I got time. The beautiful principle of integrity is here's where we start putting that back in there. If we've never had it, we put it for the first time. If we've lost it, the integrity of dealing with life on its terms, the integrity of dealing honestly with every situation that we possibly can. Admit it to God and to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. This is where this principle starts taking place in our lives. And it tells us all of AA's 12 steps. All of AA's 12 steps ask us to go contrary to our natural desires. They all deflate our egos. When it comes to ego deflation, few steps are harder to take than five. But scarcely any step is more necessary to long-time sobriety and peace of mind than this one. I want that long-time sobriety, and I want that peace of mind. And if I'm going to get it, and if I want girls to have it, I have to emphasize to them that after that step four, it's not soup yet. It's not done yet. We got to put a little bit of integrity into our lives and be willing to face what we are, what we have been, by leveling with God and ourselves and another human being. There's something therapeutic about looking in. I remember when I looked into my beautiful rose there in Alabama in Montgomery, and her eyes, and did my step five with her. Those eyes heard along with me, and they shared along with me. And it lifted such a great load, not right in the beginning, not as I was doing it, but as I was trying to live on, you know, along. The realization that I wasn't alone in this thing came to me in step five. That I really wasn't alone. I not only had that one beautiful human being that I was sitting there looking into those eyes, but I had a whole bunch of other human beings and a whole bunch of eyes to look into for the rest of my life. They would understand Willie, and they would try to help her in any way they could. This is where I got that feeling. It says, AA's experience has taught us that we cannot live alone with our pressing problems and the character defects which cause or aggravate them. Those key character defects are human defects, remember? Still got them. And they can be aggravated as a human being living in the jungle that we're living in nowadays. It's an okay jungle. I'd rather be here than out of it, that's for sure. But I can still aggravate these character defects. And by admitting them to God and to myself and to another human being, that keeps me more on the alert, because if I share that with one human being, when the time comes, I can share it with another. And even if I never verbally share some of my fifth step, I can share the idea, the good feeling. Make a comparison of some sort to help another person. And it gives me a feeling of, you know, I'm getting clean. I felt like I'm getting clean here because I felt so dirty, so dirty. If we have swept the searchlight of step four back and forth over our careers, and it has revealed in stark relief those experiences we'd rather not remember, if we have come to know how wrong thinking and action, notice not just action, but thinking, my thinking can get me into just as much trouble as acting on my thinking if it's wrong, have hurt us and others, then the need to quit living by ourselves with those tormenting ghosts of yesterday gets more urgent than ever. We have to talk to somebody about it. They reinforce all of the suggestions that they give us to be cautious, to make sure that we put our trust as nearly in someone else that we can have a lot of faith in. There's a lot of folks around. And this is, step five is terribly hard for us women to do, because it's our basic instinct not to trust each other. That's not alcoholic women, honey. That's women. And that's something that we don't do on purpose. That starts way down in first grade. Watch your young'uns, watch little kids, and watch the gals. I've watched those little first graders when I would have that in the elementary schools, and I'd watch them, and after about the second day of school, they'd pair off in their little groups, and this group over here didn't have anything to do with this group over here. And all this little group, if you're my best friend, you can't be her best friend. I don't want you to have anything to do with her. Hon, that's a basic part of a woman's nature. We started way down. Nobody teaches us that. To not trust each other. That's an underlying cross we have to bear. But by George, we can pick up that cross and run with it. We can change that. And the beauty of learning to love other women is something to behold. It's something that will add a dimension to your life that a lot of women around you won't ever more know that joy. Because we're working against something that's normal for us to do, and that's not be comfortable telling a woman too much, because we don't ever know how much is going to go out the other way. And I know some of you men are pretty good at passing things along, but I think you all will all admit that we outdo you. And it tells us all the steps to take to be cautious about and have faith in that person. I had absolute faith by that time in one human being, that woman there in Montgomery, Alabama. I knew that when I told her, gave her my fifth step, and she shared hers with me so lovingly, that it was in the vault, it was in the bank vault. And there it stayed. But it tells us, you know, how we can go about getting this feeling, and that what to do in case we can't get it about each other. But I felt like I was so fortunate that I did find that woman. And so many times, you'd be surprised, after you know a woman well enough and have watched her, does she walk like she talks? If you do want to do your fifth step within the bounds of AA and with another alcoholic. I watched Rose. I listened to her talk at meeting, but I mainly watched. I watched how she treated the new woman that walked in the door. That she didn't do what is normal for women to do, and that's, I'm going to hold off a little bit here, and I won't give her my phone number. I'll see how things go. I'll see if she really means business. And that measuring stick, because we can communicate a message, us gals can, to each other with a look. And y'all know about that look. A new woman walks in and just watch the expression, especially if she's a real good-looking babe and about 30 years younger. You know, we just can look at her and make her feel less than. And when we begin to build this faith with each other, then we're going to be automatically better to every human being that comes into our path. All these things will come back to us. They'll come back and haunt us. And it's sort of after we finish our step five and we begin to see what these things are that later on we're going to be asking those to be removed. But first, you can't remove anything. It's sort of like trying to take a stain out when we don't know what caused the stain. You have better luck taking it out if you know what it is. Because there's certain things you shouldn't put on, say, blood stains, or certain things on mustard stains, or certain things on anything with grease. And there's no sense in doctoring something or trying to fix it if you don't know it's there and what it's composed of. Is it fear, Willie? Is that what's so out of balance with you? Is it guilt? Is it pride? Is it ego? And this, in that fifth step, this sort of helps us clear the way to really take on step six and seven and eight and nine. Because, you know, our first three steps, one, two, and three, we're getting right with God, with our higher power, if you will. In four, five, six, and seven, we're getting right with ourselves. In 8 and 9, we are getting right with our fellow human beings. And in 10, 11, and 12, we're growing. Those are our growing steps. So in this step 5, our attempt to get right with ourselves, not taking what other people have done to us or what they're going to do to us or what they might do to us, but Willie, what's your problem? What's your problem, honey? Let's make a list of your problems and let's talk to somebody about it. And that takes the sting out of them. Then I don't have to live by them all by myself. Don't have to live with them. Okay, I know you've been beautiful. You've been so patient. And it's harder to sit and listen than it is to stand up here and talk and listen. And y'all have been real faithful. The real stout-hearted ones will show up again at 2 o'clock this afternoon. So I'll know who's a faint heart and sore seat when you don't show up. That's be all right. So let's break and eat, and then I'll see you back here at 2 o'clock. Thank you, honey. Thank you, sugar. I thought maybe I'd be Diane or something this time. Something pretty, you know, Willie. You can change it any way you want to.
My name is Willie, and I am an alcoholic. And we've lost a few, but that's all right, because it's nap time. And any of you that drop off a little bit, that won't disturb me. Take your little nap. After lunch, that's what we're all supposed to do. And if I drop off, Fred's going to come over and wake me up. Okay, but I do promise you this. They gave me a little extra time on the tail end of this. So what I'm going to do, I know that the mind can just absorb as much as the back end will. And therefore, I'll give you a little break right in between. That way we can get out and stretch around a little bit and then come back. So I'm not going to keep you all the length of time I did this morning, but we got started a little bit late. Okay. We're at step six. How many were not here this morning? Oh, a whole bunch. Good. Oh, yeah, play catch up. Okay, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink of alcohol since June the 19th, 1957. And I want to tell you that that's because the reason I tell you that is to give you the absolute guarantee that this program works in fair weather and foul, just like we're going to see as we do this 12 and 12. It will work through any circumstance in your life, with any crisis, with any grief and sorrow, with any loss. It works. And that's why we need to give our sobriety date, even whether we're sitting in a meeting and that newcomer's sitting there and just thinking to himself, just as we did, can I stay sober? Will it really work? And we're the only track record. Each one of us are the only track record that new person has. Whether it's three, in fact, a lot of times you people with 2 and 3 years, that newcomer can identify with them a lot quicker than those that, you know, those old sober heads that have been sitting there and blood's running off of us, you know. But so don't ever skip your sobriety date, especially if there's any new people around. It's telling them this will work. It'll work out there in the jungle as well as in closed up little meeting rooms. All right, we get to step six. And our principle behind that step is willingness. This is certainly a principle. All of our others, our hope and our faith and our integrity and our honesty, we need those in every area of our lives. If we want to live to become usefully whole, as they told us in that first step, if we can become useful to other people, all of those principles need to be in our everyday life, because they're not only going to be listening to, we got a lot of good speakers this weekend. I'm looking forward to all of them. Some of them I know, and I'm looking forward to them. And we go home with our buckets just full. And that's all well and good. But as we go along in our little home groups and we watch each other walk, that's what we do. And we watch the people that have more sobriety than we do. We watch if they walk like they talk. And so it's each one of these principles that we try to put into our lives don't just apply when we're, you know, around AA tables or in an AA room. We take it on home, as the old country western song, you know, we back it up and take it on home. And then we take it into our workplace, and we take it to the cleaners when we deal with the little person that takes our clothes, and to the drugstore when we deal with that girl in the grocery store, and to the bank. That we really need all of these things when we get to the bank. To remember that everybody out there that we deal with in our little orbits, and we each live, we don't live on a planet, do we? We live in a little orbit that usually consists of where we circulate and the people that we touch every day of our lives or every week of our lives. And those are the people, they don't know we're in AA, but maybe we can, you know, by just being the very best that we can, I try to be I learned a long time ago that the most important thing that I wear is the expression on my face. And that's not just at an AA meeting. It's everywhere. Because I never know when I'm dealing with somebody what kind of day they're having. I don't know how their day started off. It might have been real bad. And maybe by just giving them that smile, they'll take it for a smile of approval. And that's good. That's just a little piece in my orbit, just a little tiny piece. But that's all I occupy. Willingness is such a good principle to take into our life. The willingness to try new things, different things. To deal with what we're handed. The willingness to say, okay, this is not exactly the way I planned it out. But the willingness to say, oh, what kind of changes can I make to make this easier for myself and for everybody around me? Instead of, you know, sitting around and saying, oh, God, why me? Because isn't it funny that we're so quick to do that? I know I certainly was. And yet when something real good happens, I never did think to cast an eye upward and say, you know, Lord, why me, Lord? But I was very quick to do with the why me. What I'm doing when I do this is really wishing that it happened to somebody else. Subconsciously, that's what I'm doing. And that's an attitude. And this whole thing is about attitudes. Now, we've finished up with getting right, you know, with our attitude towards ourselves and our God. We're not finished, but I mean, we're fixing to finish up with our 6 and 7, where we're getting sort of even with ourselves and getting ourselves on an even keel again, so that we can go both ways and straighten up in a hurry. But the willingness to try to deal with life, I've had to deal with the fact that, you know, as each year passes, I get older. I have a little girl now that I sponsor, and oh dear Lord, she has her 50th birthday coming up. Oh my, we are talking crisis here. And of course, I sort of ruffle her feathers because when she says 50, and I say, big deal, you know. But the thing of it is, when we go through these stages in our lives, I want this program to go into that pine box with me. And I want the happiness and contentment that it's brought me and the ability to deal with anything that comes along. The willingness to try to change my attitude about it instead of trying to change somebody else's attitude. I know that as alcoholics, sometimes we seem to have a perception problem about willingness to take what's handed to us. By perception problem, it's sort of, you know, you have somebody, just a normal old Joe Blow out there, that doesn't take himself quite so seriously as we are prone to do at times. And he'll have a flat tire and he'll just, you know, get out and go over and call AAA. And if we let ourselves get into too big a hassle about ourselves, we have a flat tire and we call suicide prevention. I mean, we can get into some real big deals. I know I can sometime complicate a one-car funeral, but because I have this tendency to make big deals out of everything, because, see, I did for such a long time when Willie was so busy changing. In this willingness, I know I learned one good lesson from my beautiful sponsor. And she said, Willie, be willing to listen to people, especially those people that you disagree with. And she said, I found something a long time ago that helps me and has made me a lot of friends where I could have made enemies. She said, if I'm talking to somebody and I really don't agree with what they're saying, I simply tell them, well, I don't agree with what you say, but I'm going to think about it. And man, that relieves a bad situation sometime, where you can really get into a fit of pique over, you know, a disagreement with somebody. And they don't know whether you're going to really think about it or not, but you've held out the carrot. And that makes them feel better. And you know, after I started practicing it, it made me feel better. If I could say that and not go off in a huff because I could not convince them of what I believed. I have to be particularly careful about that during our political structure going on. Because I'm very active in politics, and when the elections come along, I'm busier than 14 bird dogs. And I have to be very careful and have to say, well, I don't agree with what you say, but I'm going to think about it. And that's a good way to, you know, win friends and influence people. And it influences Willie, too, because by just doing that, I relieve myself of the fact that I know I'm right. Because that gets so tiresome. And most of the time, if I just consider from their angle what they're saying, I don't necessarily have to do a 180-degree turn and agree with them. But the willingness to listen to other people and not jump in with our two cents. In step six, we've looked at these defects. In step four, we've talked about them. In step five, with another human being and God and ourselves. And this is the time when we have to start doing something. But this one, step six, says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. This is a step that separates the men from the boys. So declared a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of AA's greatest friends. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness and honesty to try repeatedly step six on all ring around his faults without any reservations whatever has indeed come a long way spiritually and is therefore entitled to be called a man who is sincerely trying to grow in the image and the likeness of his new creator, his own creator. Of course, the often disputed question of whether God can and will, under certain circumstances, remove defects of character will be answered with a prompt affirmative by almost any AA member. And at first I took this, you know, you can take any statement that you want to out of our literature, out of the big, big book, and if you don't really study and think about what it's saying, I know I try so hard in school to get kids to not just read words, but to read thoughts and to think about what they've read, to think about what it really means. And when I first read this, it gave me the idea that if I was just good enough, good, then God would remove all these defects of character. And this was a mistaken idea on my part. And very gradually, I saw how he was going to do it. He was going to so fix my mind that I could live to the best of my ability each day that I'm granted. And that was the way he was going to remove my defects of character, by my practice over and over of living to the very best of my ability. And to be as honest about my relationships with people and to be honest with Willie and to practice all of these things that I had gone through, to keep a list of those defects and practice the opposite. That's the way God was going to remove my defects of character. He was actually going to let me do it. He wasn't going to swoop down and say, Willie, you're just as pure as the driven snow. Because I don't think he could even gasp that out. But I believe that I found that in my case and many people that I work with, that just simply during the practice of being the opposite to what you find you are, the opposite of being dishonest is to be honest and to, you know, overcome envy is to be glad when people, I've even trained myself this, believe it or not, even when our jackpot went up to $80 million a couple of weeks ago in our lottery in Texas. $80 million. And just think about it. And one person won that 80 million. But to quickly, in my heart, instead of, you know, oh, probably didn't need it as much as I did, blah, 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 to really be glad and hope that, and God, they're intending to do a lot of good things with that money. A lot of good things. And to really train myself to be happy for other people's good fortune and not always wanting it to happen to me. Of course, I very vigorously tore up my ticket, but then after I got through with that fit, you know, I was taught to never be ashamed of anger in any way on the freeway when somebody has missed you by that far. To never be ashamed of just flaring up there for a minute, because anger is a part of being a useful person. The only time we need to regret it is when we handle anger badly. So to, you know, to, I'll pick up the paper and see, as I said this morning, man's inhumanity to man. There's no way that I can remain a human being and not react to some of that. And just, ooh, I just go into a rage. But see, my AA program has told me it's okay for it to visit, Willie. Real short visit. Just don't let it unpack its suitcases and live with you. That I can. It's a human reaction to read some of this stuff and say, how can a person do this to other human beings? And just be seething about it for a few minutes. But then I back off, as my program has taught me, and say, now, Willie, that's not your problem. Just see that you avoid any pitfall that comes along. And it's hard. It's hard to balance between trying to be a basically good person and not walking on water. I'm always scared of that halo, because I always think, well, there's only 6 inches between a halo and a noose. And that ain't very far. And I'm afraid my halo might slip down here and choke me to death. So it's not that. It's just how I handle these things. When the little, like I say, when Minnie Mouse gets loose and I want to make an excuse about something to somebody, then to be able to realize that, wait a minute, you're going to tell a lie here in a minute. And just check myself. That's what it is telling us to do, to be ready. By being ready, it was emphasized to me in the beginning, by being ready is that I dealt with each day of my life to the very best of my ability, using the opposite of what I had found in step four. To take those defects that had really become part of me, they never were a part of me before. Being critical of other people, which is a way down cut its envy. But all these things had never been a part of my makeup. I had had a good, busy life, but they had seeped in as the alcoholism chipped away at me. But if I practice the opposite, then I'm in pretty good shape. And that's all I have to be willing to do. In this step, it just tells us to be ready. And to be ready, I have to do each day what I think is the right thing to do. Sometimes I don't always choose what's right. But at least if I keep it uppermost in my mind, I'm going to give it a try. It says, of course, the often disputed question of whether God can and will, under any circumstances, remove defects of character will be answered with a prompt affirmative by almost any AA member. To him, this proposition will be no theory at all. It will be just about the largest fact in his life. He'll usually offer his proof in a statement like this: sure, I was beaten. Absolutely licked. My own willpower just wouldn't work on alcohol. Change of scene, the best efforts of family, friends, doctors, clergymen, got no place with my alcoholism. I simply couldn't stop drinking, and no human power being could seem to do the job for me. And that certainly holds true, doesn't it? But when I became willing to clean house, and then ask a higher power, God as I understand him, to give me release. My obsession to drink vanished. It was lifted right out of me. When I truly ask God, God, remove this obsession. Teach me how to live in such a way by using this program that this obsession won't ever come back, and it never has. The obsession is gone. Sometime watching the television is pretty hard on a hot Texas day when it's 105 out there and the humidity is 99. And they come on the television with these frosted mugs of beer. And they're telling you how much fun a Miller High Life, you know, involves. And the foam's coming over the top. I have a fleeting thought. Yeah, that'd be good. My obsession isn't back. That's just a human thought. It's just a human thought. Just like, you know, man, it'd been good to win that $80 million. I'd have brought y'all all down to Texas this weekend. Not that I'm not glad to be here, because I am. But all of those I've learned are human reactions. And that if I take them immediately and tend to them, that it's all right. In AA meetings all over the world, statements just like this are heard daily. It's plain for everybody to see that each sober AA member has been granted a release from the very obstinate and potentially fatal obsession. So in a very complete and literal way, all AAs have become entirely ready to have God remove the mania for alcohol from their lives. And God has proceeded to do exactly that. Because you can't take these steps and start putting them, the basics, into your life, the inventory, and later on doing the daily inventory. And you can't do these things sincerely and with the best effort that you have, even though it isn't perfect, without getting better. Having then been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, why then shouldn't we be able to achieve by the same means a perfect release from every other difficulty or defect? This is a riddle of our existence, the full answer to which may be only in the mind of God. Nevertheless, at least a part of the answer to it is apparent to us. So Bill's telling us there that, yeah, this is a dilemma. Why, if God lifted this obsession 37 years ago, why isn't it that he can't lift any of the defects of character completely out of my life? And he makes it clear here that there's really not any pat answer to this. I think it's dependent entirely on how much effort I put into it. But even then, see, I can't put 100% effort because of the halo thing. We're just not going to get them, folks. I don't think most of us are in line because of the human beingness. It said when men and women pour so much alcohol into themselves that they destroy their lives, they commit a most unnatural act, defying the instinctual desire for self-preservation, they seem bent upon self-destruction. You know, there's really no good reason for any of us alcoholics to be here today. Think of the number of times that we took our lives into our hands and just defied God. We defied that instinct of self-preservation, which is one of the strongest instincts that we have. If you don't believe it, go into a nursing home and see that survival instinct. When a little old human being comes to, you know, 70 pounds, and there's nothing there but just skin and bones, but that survival instinct is there. And they keep on surviving. Keep on surviving. Because it's so strong. And here we are. We defied death over and over and over again. Just think of all the times we got in those automobiles and drove. I've driven across some of the biggest cities in the United States and half of Europe, and got home the next morning and went out to see if the car was there. Had no memory. The fact that we're alive, and we were so intent, not consciously, but we just shook our hands at it and defied, and we somehow or another we survived. Somehow or another, I reckon who's responsible? Who do you think? We certainly weren't. Even the people that didn't, you know, run over us or into us, they're not. Because all they were doing was dodging. But we're here. They work against their own deepest instinct. And as they are humbled by the terrific beating administered by alcohol, the grace of God can enter them and expel their obsession. Here, their powerful instinct to live can fully cooperate with their Creator's desire to give them a new life. For nature and God abhor suicide. But most of our other difficulties don't fall under such a category at all. Every normal person wants, for example, to eat, to reproduce, and to be somebody. And not necessarily some big body, but just somebody. To mean something to somebody. That's, as we read, that's a basic instinct. To be meaningful to other people that we're around, that we love and want them to love us. That's a natural desire. And he wishes to be reasonably safe and secure as he tries to attain these things. Indeed, God made him that way. He did not design man to destroy himself by alcohol, but he did give man instincts to help him to stay alive. Thank God for those instincts, because that's what kept a lot of us from getting killed. We instinctively did, and couldn't remember it the next day. We were completely under the influence of an anesthetic, the most powerful and the oldest that there is in mankind. During our early wars, if they needed to amputate a man's leg, they gave him enough alcohol and they cut that leg off. They've never found really a better anesthetic than alcohol. And we poured so much of it into our bodies. I'm amazed every time I think and I see a group of AAs just looking out there and think of how many of us just shook our fist and defied something to happen. And that wasn't on a conscious level, but it had to be there. It's nowhere evident, at least in this life, that our Creator expects us fully to eliminate our instinctual drives. So far as we know, it is nowhere on the record that God has completely removed from any human being all his natural drives. It's those misdirected. Since most of us are born with the abundance of natural desires, it isn't strange that we often let these far exceed their intended purpose. When they drive us blindly, or we willfully demand that they supply us with more satisfaction or pleasures than are possible to or do us, that is the point at which we depart from the degree of perfection that God wishes for us here on earth. The degree of perfection, not for the perfection. That is the measure of our character defects, or if you wish, of our sins. If we ask, God will certainly forgive our derelictions. But in no case does he render us white as snow and keep us that way without our cooperation. That is something that we are supposed to be willing to work towards ourselves. He only asks only that we try as best we know how to make progress in the building of character. That's what step says, step six. Let's get ready to have, let God remove these defects of character. But we got to help him. We can't just lie there and say, God, do it, do it, do it. If we ask, God will certainly forgive these derelictions. It says on down, so in step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, is AA's way of stating the best possible attitude. Man, that's a big word. Attitude. Attitude can it can really do a lot, can it? But it's AA's way of stating the best possible attitude that one can take in order to make a beginning on this lifetime job. So they're not saying that we can do step 6 just by saying, okay, God, I'm tired. I'm ready for you to remove all these defects of character. And then conduct ourselves each day in the opposite direction. Bill, I think, makes it real clear to us that if we want this, then we have to cooperate. And we have to practice the opposite of everything that we've found. I don't know, this attitude thing, and I know that many, many of you have read the little thing on attitude. And I love it because it can change. Attitude can change our whole day for us. If we get up in the morning and fix that attitude, it can start making our day. It can turn absolute disasters into something that we can deal with. This does not mean that we expect all of our character defects to be lifted out of us as the drive to drink was. A few of them may be, but with most of them, we shall have to be patient, content with patient improvement, little by little. The key words, entirely ready, underline the fact that we want to aim at the very best we know or can learn. By doing the opposite, I learned so much and so much new stuff, and the good feelings that I got from doing this stuff, the attitude that I could adjust. How many of us have this degree of readiness? In an absolute sense, practically nobody has it. Absolute willingness? The best we can do with all the honesty that we can summons is to try. I love that as a ring around word, to have it. Even then, the best of us will discover to our dismay that there is always a sticking point, a point at which we say, no, I can't give that up yet. I know none of y'all ever did that. No, it feels good all over to get just roaring, screaming mad and to blast everybody in sight and to cuss that man that just missed me on the freeway by that far and to shake my fist at him. We don't do that much in Houston because it'll get you shot. But a good mad, you know, can really, it stirs up the blood and the adrenaline gets flowing and it's just such a... But then after it's all over with, you remember the drained feeling that you have? And I don't want to feel drained, because I don't ever know when God wants to use me in any way. But you feel like, you know, an old dirty wash rag just wound out when you get through with all those turning the air blue with what you're calling him all the way down the freeway. He's out of sight. He's probably home drinking a beer by now, and you're still cussing him and being, never see him again as long as you live. But you've spent all this energy, and I'll catch myself doing that every once in a while, just use up all this energy that I could be storing up to really put in a good place. I'm putting it on this dude that's all the way down the road, drinking his beer at home, and I'm still mad. And it's so much easier for me if I can just jerk myself up real quick and say, God, I hope he doesn't hit anybody else, and thank you, God, for not letting him hit me. Then I'm through with it. I'm through. Every dirty word in the book's not going to help him any. But if I wish him well, see, I tried. He works in, I've seen him work in some ways that I didn't even think he could work. But see, if I ask him, dear God, don't let him hit anybody else. And maybe you can get through to him to drive a little bit better, be a little bit more careful so that he won't hurt somebody else or himself. And that leaves me, see, with not an ugly feeling. And I like not ugly feeling. I like that smooth, smooth thing that I can feel if I can adjust my attitude and my thinking real quick. It takes a lot of practice. And as they say, though, we don't have to get to be perfectionists at it. On page 68, down in the middle of that second paragraph there, it says, only step one, where we made the 100% admission that we were powerless over alcohol, can be practiced with absolute perfection. That's the only thing I have done in 37 years to perfection. The rest of these 12 steps, each one of them tell me that I am to practice, practice, practice. Because as each year goes along, I realize that I have to practice in a different way. As each trauma or grief or sorrow or anything comes along, I have to practice it in a different way. But only step one has to be done 100%. I hate to be in a meeting when I hear someone say that, you know, well, I've been coping with this problem, I've been dealing with this problem, and it's just not getting any better, and I've prayed to God, and I've been coming to meetings, and I've been reading the big book, and it's just not getting any better. And it's a way of them saying, you know, my program is letting me down, it's not working. Oh, yeah. Where are you when you're saying that? You're sitting in an AA meeting, and you could be hanging off a bar stool in a back alley someday, sucking on a bottle, with or without a pacifier. That's the thing I try to keep in my mind when I pass by whiskey bottles or see them, anything. I always put a pacifier on the end of them. And I think to myself, you know, that's what I do when I'm drinking. I'm pulling on a pacifier just like a little baby for instant gratification. We get used to wanting infant gratification because we have so much microwaves and instant everything, potatoes and coffee and rice. And so we get into, I want it now, right now. Really, I want it yesterday. So I have to check myself on that and remember that the only step that I am to do 100% is the first one. The remaining 11 steps state perfect ideals. They are goals towards which we look and the measuring sticks by which we estimate our progress. Seen in this light, step 6 is still difficult, but not at all impossible. The only urgent thing is that we make a beginning and keep trying. Okay, in that step we became willing. We said, okay, God, if you'll help, I'll help. I'll cooperate in every possible way. We move on to step 7. And here we begin to practice a principle in our lives that we're going to need for the rest of our lives if we want to have the peace and calm that this program. And the freedom is humility, because it takes us out of the center of us. And humility, the word, scared me to death in the beginning. And I wish I would have paid more attention to what the 12 and 12 says here about humility, because it puts it in a more practical way than I had it. I had it in the hair shirt bracket, sitting up on the mountaintop, contemplating. Humility was just a real weird thing as far as I was concerned. And I couldn't see how you could be effective and be humble. I sort of like Mac Davis in his song, you know, oh Lord, it's hard to be humble. But I found out that I had the wrong idea about humility. It says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now see what it says. It says, since this step so specifically concerns itself with humility, we should pause here to consider what humility is and what the practice of it can mean to us. Indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the fundamental principle of each of AA's 12 steps. For without some degree of humility, no alcoholic can stay sober at all. Didn't say with perfect, but with some degree of humility. And if you don't look out trying to practice this program, you get a little more and a little more and a little more each day. Nearly all AAs have found, too, that unless they develop much more of this precious quality than may be required just for sobriety, they still haven't much chance of becoming truly happy. And I'm greedy for that, too. Truly happy. And to really know what truly happy means, not, you know, ring-a-ding-da-doo, everybody up and around, but that quiet in a storm as it goes through, that quiet that we can have. Without it, they cannot live to much useful purpose without this little bit of this humility, or in adversity, be able to summon the faith that can meet any emergency. Humility as a word and as an ideal has a very bad time of it in our world. Not only is the idea misunderstood, the word itself is often intensely disliked. Many people haven't even a nodding acquaintance with humility, and look what he tells us, as a way of life. Humility is a quality, all right, but it's a quality that encompasses attitudes, our whole outlook, the way of life that we lead, the just trying to do the right thing. If one day you get up and, you know, God, help me keep my thinking straight today. Just trying with that. And it becomes, humility becomes a way of life rather than a thing. We can identify anger because, you know, our blood pumps and our face gets red and, you know, shooting stars out of our eyes and all that kind of stuff. You can identify envy and jealousy with certain acts and thoughts. But humility, it's hard to think of it. In fact, it can't be pinned down to a definition or a reaction. It's a way of life, he says here. And I was so happy when I began to get a little understanding of what he was talking about. So that when I did ask him to remove these defects of character, then I could do it in a way that my life will be here for you, God. It's going to be fertile ground, so start planting. I'll do the tilling of the soil, and you make everything else grow for me, please. I have to till that soil. I have to make it ready. I can't just say, you know, God, I'm being so good that I know you'll do all this stuff for me. That's an attitude. Much of the everyday talk that we hear and a great deal of what we read highlights man's pride in his own achievements. Goes on to a list, and just to think of all the achievements that man has made. My little father passed away 2 years ago. He was 97 years old. And God bless him, he went out cussing the Astros and the Oilers because he wouldn't win a ball game. But he had such a beautiful, full life. Can you imagine a 97-year span? Think of all the things that this man witnessed in his life. He went from the horse and buggy, with just the horse first because they weren't even, you know, didn't have a buggy. Just the horse. To watching a man get out and walk on the moon, to an old pot-bellied wood stove, to a microwave, airplanes, telephones, radios, television. This man had watched it all. And you know, we're watching a lot of it. And it tends to give us an idea that, you know, man can do anything. Just do anything. And this is natural for us to believe this because we've seen these miraculous things happen. And we're in for a lot more miraculous things. Technology is just going crazy. You know, watch these kids in school now. You know, they don't have to take their pencil and paper and do any kind of math. They just start punching buttons. Say, dadgummit, why couldn't we have done it that way when I was learning it? But it seemed like magic all over. Everywhere we look, there's technology going on. And we have a tendency then to think that it's man's job to really use our full potential, which it is, but that we can accomplish all these things. Do we have the idea, in other words, that that all man's accomplishments were done just because men were so smart that they figured it out? I imagine, you know, God had a little bit to do with them getting out and shooting golf balls on the moon. I imagine so. The intelligence, the discipline that it took to not only make that thing, but to take those men and give them that self-discipline and that training, vigorous, hard training. I was always amazed. My husband flew for 22 years in two wars with people shooting at him. And when he retired from the United States Air Force, he didn't even have ingrown toenails. It amazed me that this man could fly an airplane for that long and go through two wars. But see, he was self-disciplined. He disciplined himself. He followed a set of a code of rules, a code of living. If he would have climbed in that airplane any time and the mind wasn't clear, one of those people shooting at him might have gotten him. So man contributes, yes, but man doesn't do it all. He doesn't send those storms that those airplanes have to fly through. And no matter how ready the astronauts are to go and how ready the machine is, you know, the spaceship ready to go, if the weather says, it doesn't go. They control everything that's going on in all this space exploration except the weather. And there it is. It keeps them grounded. It keeps them from taking off. So see, we're not quite as big in control as we think we are. If I train myself to think of those things, then I can realize who's really in charge here. Who's really in charge. On page 72, down at the bottom, it says, "For us, the process of gaining a new perspective was unbelievably painful. It was only by repeated humiliations that we were forced to learn something about humility. It was only at the end of a long road marked by successive defeats and humiliations and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency that we began to feel humility as something more than a condition of groveling despair. Every newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous is told and soon realizes for himself that his humble admission of powerlessness over alcohol is his first step toward liberation from its paralyzing grip." The minute we know, wait a minute, I can't do this anymore. I can't. All my big ideas of control and changing cities and changing spouses and changing everything is not working. I've got to have help. That's our first step into humility. That's our first step. On down in that middle paragraph, it says, "When we finally admitted without reservation that we are powerless over alcohol, we are apt to breathe a sigh of relief, saying, 'Well, thank God, that's over. I'll never have to go through that again.' Then we learn, often to our consternation, that this is only the first milestone on the new road that we're walking. Still goaded by sheer necessity, we reluctantly come to the grips with those serious character flaws that made problem drinkers